Депутатом Госдумы Геннадием Гудковым. Об этом сообщил официальный
блогер Алексей Навальный. Теперь будет появляться.
Что Навальный будет не единственным оппозиционным представителем
оппозиции. В Москве заявил его создатель, бывший министр финансов Алексей Кудрин. По его словам, именно...
Миллиардер Прохоров признался, что хотел...
What do State Duma deputy Геннадий Гудков, anti-corruption blogger Алексей Навальный, former finance minister Алексей Кудрин and billionaire oligarch Mikhail Prokhorov have in common? They've all, to varying degrees, recently had their feet in both the establishment and opposition camps. Until recently, Gudkov, a KGB veteran, was a Kremlin-loyal Duma deputy. He's now one of the regime's most outspoken critics. Navalny is known for his fiery speeches at opposition rallies and his exposés of official corruption. But this week, he accepted a seat on the board of directors of the state-controlled airline Aeroflot. Kudrin, a personal friend of President Vladimir Putin, had long served as his finance minister. But since resigning last autumn, he's been scathing in his assessment of Kremlin policy. And Prokhorov, who made and kept his billions by being loyal to Putin's Kremlin, is now flirting with the opposition and has formed his own political party. And these are just a few of many examples. When Russia enters times of political change and its future directions in doubt, much of the elite is forced to become political entrepreneurs, hedging their bets in an effort to stay ahead of the curve of whatever new order eventually emerges. But being a political entrepreneur also carries risks and costs. This week, for example, prosecutors announced plans to investigate Gudkov for alleged tax evasion. Kudrin, once one of Russia's most powerful and influential figures, now finds himself on the sidelines. And after he was named to the Aeroflot board, Navalny was lambasted on the Russian blogosphere for, in the words of his critics, selling out to the authorities. How ugly, one blogger wrote, the hero of the opposition has sold his soul for an airplane. Meet Russia's political entrepreneurs. What's their angle, and what role are they poised to play in this period of instability? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name's Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. My regular co-host, Kirill Coburn, is off this week enjoying a much-deserved vacation. And if you're listening, Kirill, I hope you're having a good time. But the good news is, filling in for Kirill and joining us from Vermont, thanks to the amazing magic of Skype technology, is Mark Galliotti, someone Power Vertical fans should by now be familiar with. But for those who aren't, Mark is a professor of global affairs at New York University and the author of one of my favorite Russia blogs, In Moscow's Shadows. He's also the author and editor of numerous books on Russia and writes the regular Moscow news column, Siloviks and Scoundrels. Welcome back, Mark. Thanks for agreeing to fill in today. You're becoming quite a regular here, quite a regular member of the Power Vertical podcast team.
Hey, it's always fun to be involved.
It's fun to have you here. Mark, credit where credit's due. It was something you said on this podcast months ago that gave me the inspiration for today's topic. Back in January, we were discussing Prokhorov's presidential candidacy, and you said the following about Prokhorov. I don't think that he has rolled in, as he himself has proclaimed, as an anti-Kremlin candidate with no connections to the Putin circle. There is some degree of connectivity there. But on the other hand, simply to write Prokhorov off as a complete Kremlin stooge would be a mistake. The point is that everyone is a political entrepreneur in their own right in the current situation because nobody knows what is going to happen. Prophetic words. And since then, we've been seeing a lot more political entrepreneurship going on, more hedging of bets. Just this week, for example, it caught my eye that a petition to free the feminist punk rock band Pussy Riot from prison attracted signatures from some notable Putin supporters, which is another sign that people are really not quite sure what side of all this they should be on. How long do you see this state of affairs lasting, Mark? Or, on the other hand, is all this political and entrepreneurship just a sign that Russia's politics is becoming more normal, or at least edging towards normalcy?
Well, it's always a dangerous thing to proclaim normalcy is on the way for Russia, but... Nonetheless, I mean, I think there is some truth in that. But the point is that to get there from here, then there will have to be some major transition, some major fracturing of the current state system. I think really to explain why there's such political entrepreneurship around at the moment, it is very much a case of A, the insecurities and uncertainties within the elite, B, at the moment, a lack of a clear steer from Putin and the Kremlin, and C, perhaps most fundamentally of all, the fact that people are thinking in terms of change. Even if you're a diehard Putinist, you're thinking, well, how can we manage the change? For most people, it's a question of, well, they're not quite sure what kind of change is going to happen, but they do believe that some kind of change is on the way. And that, for me, is incredibly important, and from the point of view of the sort of the elite, a corrosive factor. Up to now, the idea, you know, one of the things that have bound the elite together has been that sense that they could basically be in command for perpetuity. Now they're uncertain about that.
And this is probably one of the biggest, this is probably the fundamental change that we've witnessed since the December, disputed December Duma elections. Yes, that this uncertainty all became manifest. It appears to have been latent before that, though, wasn't it?
Yes, and I think also that the whole business around the castling, when Putin and Medvedev just sort of announced, oh, by the way, this is the way it's going to be in the future, I think also brought that into sharp relief. But no, really, it's the past, and it's extraordinary to think of it as just such a short period. The past 7 months have really seen this come to the fore. And the point is, these things become self-fulfilling prophecies. The more people start thinking about a post-Putin future or a sort of a post-change future, then the more likely that becomes. Just as in the past, it was precisely because people didn't believe anything would happen that they didn't bother trying to get involved for change.
And this is just another way that Putin has lost the as we talked about back in January in this podcast, the air of invincibility that he enjoyed up until now. Once that air is pierced, all bets are off, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, again, sort of let's take advantage of the fact that Kirill isn't here to sort of throw in a historical analogy. his usual Benoit is, in some ways, we have seen a, thank God, peaceable equivalent of Bloody Sunday, the massacre that didn't bring down the Tsarist regime, but very much, I think, sort of shattered the essential legitimacy of the Tsarist regime. In that sense that the Tsar was clearly the, sort of the representative of God on earth. And at that point, the slide to revolution or the slide to some kind of change was basically one that was inexorable. Well, so too, again, it took over a decade for the Tsarist regime to collapse. But nonetheless, it happened. Well, so too, we don't really know the time frame here, but I think the sense that the Putin regime is heading towards some kind of shattering, transforming, whatever, sort of, but nonetheless, some kind of definite change is pretty palpable.
Yeah, I keep going back to Nicholas Gvozdev's quote. I've used it again and again and again, but you can put the genie back in the bottle, but the bottle's going to have to change its shape. I'm beginning to wonder if the bottle's going to have to break.
Well, it's pretty hard to change the shape of a bottle when it's also under pressure.
Mm-hmm. to push the metaphor further, yeah.
Exactly, and which I know there's always a danger with pushing metaphors so far that they lose.
But no, I think we're still okay with that one. I mean, on the other hand, Mark, there are tools at Putin's disposal to get people in line, and the tax investigation against Gudkov that came to light this week is one of those tools. Are there risks involved in using those tools, though?
Of course they are, and the point is that also that kind of approach only has a limited value. I mean, again, if we're pulling this back slightly, very, very broadly speaking, any kind of regime depends on three ways of controlling its people, its elites, its society. Legitimacy, that they obey because they believe it's right. Co-optation, they obey because it's in their personal and collective interests. And coercion, they obey because they're afraid of what's going to happen to them. Now, in the past, actually, the Putin regime has been quite sophisticated about how it's used all three of those approaches. It's pushed this notion of nationalism and rebuilding a strong, powerful Russia for all Russians to legitimate it. It's also ensured that a lot of people can actually do very well out of the status quo. And there's always been that ever-present shadow of coercion, whether it's through tax investigations or worse. The fact that increasingly we're seeing very little that's meaningful to try and legitimate the regime, tete-a-tetes with Russian Orthodox clergymen doesn't really count. We've seen very little that actually shows an ability to actually reach out and co-opt the new elites. And obviously, I know there's this whole question about Navalny, but we can come on to that later. And instead, it's much more about the issue of coercion. Coercion is essentially a short-term tactic. Yes, it says, look, you can always cause us trouble if necessary. But it doesn't actually make people want to support you.
Yeah, and speaking and going back in terms of legitimacy, Putin was genuinely popular back in the earlier part of the last decade, up until he left the presidency in 2008. He was extraordinarily popular, and this was always his ace in the hole. Now, you can argue he's still popular now, but I think that popularity, even if it is over 50%, and I sometimes have my doubts about the polls I'm seeing, it's much softer than it was. Than it was a decade or so ago, so that and that's, this is another sense that they've lost the legitimacy. The economic crisis of 2008 and kind of even though Russia got through it relatively unscathed, it kind of exposed the danger of the Putin model of being so dependent on commodities, so dependent on energy, the need to diversify, the need to modernize, which also has with it an implicit need to reform the political system. These things all cut into the coercion and the economic downturn. And Putin yesterday said that Russia should get ready for an economic crisis, which certainly caught my attention. It undermines the regime's ability to co-opt as much a bit, too. So you're right. There's little left but the coercion. And if you rely just on that, then you're in trouble. Yeah,
very much so. And I think this is one of the interesting things. We previously discussed the way that the investigations committee under Bastrykin has been very much sort of coming forward as the attack dogs of the status quo, being the ones who are sort of searching people's apartments and threatening people and so forth. Now, in the past, I would have expected that to have been part of a sort of a multi-spectrum strategy. But on the one hand, you would have had the waving of the sticks, but on the other hand, a judicious admixture of carrots and opportunities and so forth. We're not seeing that at the moment. We're seeing very much a very clumsy and heavy-handed approach, which also comes into a sort of a more general trend that we've seen, that in fact, of late, the Kremlin has been far less sure-footed in its dealings with society. And to me, that says something about the fact that they really don't understand what to do. Again, let me draw another, but very, very admittedly sort of a fanciful parallel. It's a little bit like the early days of World War II, or the Great Patriotic War. The whole system had been built around Stalin. And when, contrary to his expectations, the Nazis invaded when they did, he pretty much had something like a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
And for days, the system, which was so centralized, was paralyzed. People were desperately waiting for orders from Moscow and not getting them. And therefore, the Air Force was being shattered still on the ground. Units were being just wiped out wholesale. In some ways, and again, I really wouldn't play that parallel too much. Putin is no Stalin and vice versa.
And we're not in World War II, but I see your point.
The point is precisely that we had this incredibly centralized system that depended, if not, as it were, on Putin as a person, but shall I say, the Kremlin, the collective Putin.
Collective Putin, yeah.
Because nothing is coming out from that rarefied inner circle, in a way the system, politically speaking at least, is in paralysis.
Now, you mentioned the collective Putin, and this is something that's on my list of things to talk about here. What is this political entrepreneurship, which is a function of the political uncertainty? What is this doing to what we both have taken to calling the deep state or the collective Putin? Can we even still speak in those terms now if this is coming apart as a result of the need for all of this political entrepreneurship? Because some of these people that we mentioned were deep inside the collective Putin, if you will, or deep inside the deep state. And I haven't even gotten to Vladislav Surkov yet. It's somebody else I want to discuss a bit during this podcast. But can for the moment, can we still talk about a collective Putin? Can we still talk about a deep state?
I think we can, so far. I mean, all deep states go from time to time through, and they can survive, occasional political turmoils, restructuring, and so forth. Let's not sound its death knell too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think there's two points that's worth making. First of all, we have this perfect storm of internal political rivalries, in part because of a lack of a clear sense of direction. A pressure from without, which comes from both the elite and on a more passive level, ordinary society that are unhappy with the current status quo. And then you've got this economic pressure, which, as you said, also affects their ability to both legitimate and co-opt groups. So the first key point is actually just the extent to which this is a sort of a crisis situation from so many different directions. The second point is precisely that what's interesting is that these political entrepreneurs are not so much manoeuvring for position within the deep state, which would be the normal kind of thing. And we've seen it in the past when sort of clan conflicts bubble out into visibility, really because actually what's important is what's going on under the surface. But instead, the very fact that they are actually beginning to juggle for a potential sort of post-deep state positioning.
Mm. Or a new deep state.
Yeah, exactly. And either way, those things do, as I said, become self-fulfilling prophecies the more they happen. So, I mean, I definitely think that we are at a point in which, as it were, big stuff is happening. Whether or not we can definitely say exactly that the deep state is disappearing, or whether there's going to be something just a very different configuration that'll still manage to control. But I think handing over power from one deep state to another is a very difficult situation. And we have to realize that Russia has a pretty well-developed sort of outer elite who are also well aware of what's going on.
So we may see the demise of the current configuration of the collective Putin, but mm-hmm. not the demise of the deep state in that sense, meaning that there will be this meta elite that will basically remain regardless of how the political arrangements turn out. But it may not. Putin may no longer be the front man for it, and his inner circle may no longer be the top dogs. Is that what you mean?
Yes, absolutely. We could see, shall I say, Putinism without Putin.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, I think any such transition is going to be a very, very difficult process for this inner elite to actually pilot. And for me, that will be their most vulnerable moment. And to be quite honest, I would be surprised and faintly depressed if they actually managed to pull it off. I don't think it's possible, but probably not.
Although if this all does fall apart, all bets are really off. I mean, we don't know what will replace this configuration, and it could be more repressive than what we see now in the eyes of a lot of people. Would you agree with that?
It could be, but I don't think that's likely, or at least not for more than a very, very brief spasm of reaction. I think that actually, for so many reasons, the underlying tectonic processes at work within Russia, the rise of a new middle class, the continuing evolution of a sort of a politically literate and politically active group of people who aren't just the old corrupt inner circle and so forth. And also even the interests of ordinary Russians. I mean, we mustn't rule them out of this process themselves. And just generally the diversification of the economy, the rise of a knowledge-based economy, which is slow but happening. All of these, frankly, militate against some kind of creation of repression. The idea that we can have a Singaporean variant or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, there's something that's been lurking behind a lot of this. Kirill has alluded to it in a previous edition of the podcast. I've been seeing it written about cryptically on social media, and that is the hand of Vladislav Surkov. Now, everybody that listens to this podcast and everybody that reads my blog knows I'm fascinated with this man because he's fascinating. But the speculation goes something like this. Surkov was on the side of the elite that basically, as you put it very, very, very succinctly, wanted to keep the deep state deep, but change the front, but change the facade a bit. And that was, keep Medvedev in as president, make the Duma look a little bit more pluralistic, open up the system a bit because it needed to be opened up, because he correctly saw that there was a kind of a social explosion waiting to happen if they tried to return to the 2007 status quo. Surkov, this is where he was trying to drive things. This is where Gleb Pavlovsky was trying to drive things. This is clearly where Kudrin had hoped things were going to go. They lost the fight to the Siloviki clan of Igor Sechin and Sergei Ivanov and the others who wanted a return of Putin. This is the old struggle between the managers and the shareholders, the managers who kind of manage the system and the shareholders who had a stake in it. Or it's been called the conflict between the technocrats and the Siloviki. having lost that battle, there is a body of opinion out there that's not expressing itself too loudly, but if you look carefully enough and read between the lines in the Russian press and on the blogs, you see that there's the belief that this is happening. That a lot of what's going on right now in terms of this political entrepreneurship, and even in terms of the amount of people that they're getting out on the streets for protests, that Surkov has a bit of a hand in this. I mean, this man was, after all, a master at playing this game from the Kremlin, and some people think he's now playing it from the White House. What is that? Is that a step too far? Is that giving Surkov too much credit? Is that getting too conspiratorial? Or, as one very wise observer once told me in Russia, the question of never is if there's a conspiracy, it's which conspiracy is working. What do you think about the whole hand of Surkov in this situation?
I find it always tremendously entertaining. But frankly, Surkov, I think, has almost become a folk myth.
Yeah.
More than anything else. Everyone will want to ascribe pretty much everything, whether it's the outcome of the latest soccer results or what's going on in the streets. And in some ways, actually, how you feel about Surkov's role is more than anything else a sort of touchstone of where you lie within the political system. But I suppose I come down to practicalities. First of all, however savvy a political operator, one has to accept that there are really very, very sharp limitations as to how any one individual can actually shape the political discourse, especially when they're trying to do it secretly without full access to the tools at his disposal when he was very much the insider.
Well, although he is government chief of staff now and he has a team around him, he's not operating all by himself.
Yeah, but exactly. But the point is, he can't actually go up there onto a podium and say these kinds of things if he really is behind it. But most fundamentally, no one is indispensable. No one is bulletproof. If he really was involved, and given that precisely we see this sometimes cloaked and sometimes overt sort of chatter about his potential role, were I one of the true Siloviki, I would be making damn sure that his every cell phone conversation was monitored, etc. And as soon as if I felt that this was actually the case, I would have people kicking down his door. Mm. Now, just simply because I'm a morally bankrupt individual, and that's sort of how I would operate sitting in the Kremlin. But I find it impossible to believe that he could somehow stage manage this phenomenal, not just Moscow, but in some ways almost nationwide process without having given his enemies, of whom there are many, ample evidence to be able to go back. And let's face it, even Medvedev, I mean, even if one sort of somehow speculate that he's under Medvedev's krisha in his protection, Medvedev's position is not one that really he would benefit from some massive collapse in the deep state. It's not as though he has some huge external constituency that allowed him to kind of come back as Putin number two or whatever. So although I understand the sort of the temptation to see the master manipulator at work, let's be honest, apart from anything else, a lot of Surkov's earlier successes had nothing to do really with his own manipulations and everything to do with the price of oil and gas.
Although he is very good at what he does.
Very good at what he does, but no spin doctor is as important as that. The spin doctors would like us to believe it, but I think the reality shows otherwise.
I don't think he's manipulating the whole process by any stretch of the imagination. This is too big for that. It would be the biggest piece of Pakazuka in history. But I do think he's pulling some levers and playing his game. He's getting back at Volodin for pushing him out of the Kremlin. This is another thing that's coming up, that he's trying to make Volodin look bad. Like Volodin can't handle the situation like Surkov could in his day. But I also don't think that he or his krisha Medvedev, is seeking the overthrow of the deep state. I think they just want a different kind of a deep state.
I'd agree with you there. And again, I think we come back to this whole issue of the individual and the collective sort of political entrepreneurship and what do people want? No individual within this circle is actually trying to bring the system down. They all just want to tweak it in their own advantage. They want exactly that. They want to make their enemies look bad, their allies look good, divert a few more resources into their own hands, and so forth. The point is that the collective impact of all this sort of purely selfish activity is very, very corrosive to the state as a whole. Mm-hmm. So I definitely agree with you. I mean, clearly, Surkov is not someone who would just write off his rather high-profile, embarrassing initial earlier dismissal and replacement with Volodin as just one of those things. I'm sure he has every desire to make Volodin look bad, and yes, every now and then he will have the opportunity to tweak and to brief to that effect. Not thinking of it as part of some big campaign, but just simply part of it as just simply prosecuting a personal feud. And we see that, I think, throughout the system. Exactly, but the more that happens, the more we have all these little personal initiatives taking place, the more actually it puts the whole state, the deep state as a whole, under pressure.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to me that, and this thought just kind of came to my mind as you were speaking, that what we're seeing now is almost it's a continuation of the battle that was going on, you know, under the carpet, as the Russians would say, during the Medvedev presidency, right? And yeah. Now it's out in the open, and it's the public has kind of been brought into this battle about how to tweak this system. Does that make sense to you?
Exactly, and I think this is it. Again, it's this the point when the deep state becomes visible, and also the point at which participants within the deep state, instead of feeling they all have a sort of a common code of omerta, continuing the sort of the mafia,
right?
As it were, making sure everything stays under the carpet, are willing to allow signs of the conflict to sort of be visible to society as a whole. But also, I mean, the key thing is, yes, there were political rivalries and conflicts taking place during the Medvedev presidency. You know, as any system, doesn't matter if you're North Korea or the United States, there are always going to be rivalries within national political elites. But again, then there was this sense that, first of all, there was a common etiquette of keeping it secret as far as you could. But secondly, Putin, and to an extent Medvedev, but primarily Putin, was still active as that central arbiter, to use that sort of model that you used in your earlier podcast, that figure who was able and willing to actually, if necessary, knock heads together, if necessary, broker deals, but basically had the power and the authority to ensure that the elite sorted things out under that carpet.
Mm.
That doesn't seem to be happening now. And in part, you can explain it by the sort of disillusion of the casting and everything else. But also in part, it's because, for whatever reason, and it's still hard to know why, Putin is not playing that role.
Yeah. I thought in your most recent blog post, you compared him to the Vort of Zakonia, the thieves in law, who would broker disputes in the criminal world. And that he's lost that role as arbiter in chief. And that, going back to legitimacy, was a key source of his legitimacy inside the elite.
Exactly. I think this is it. The point at which, as it were, the Tsar becomes just another mortal. You may not sort of notice it at the time, but in fact, that is a truly fundamental change in any political system.
Right. Now, one other thing I wanted to discuss very briefly before we moved on to the next topic is, what's Navalny's game here? He got appointed to the board of Aeroflot. He's still being harassed by the authorities, but now he's on the board of directors of the National Airline. He got there through Lebedev's maneuverings on the board. That much is clear. But that board, Lebedev has 15% of the stock in Aeroflot. I mean, he had to. There had to be some of the state elite supporting him on that board, or he wouldn't have gotten enough votes to get on. What kind of game do you think is going on here?
Well, I mean, it's very hard to know quite what's going on in Navalny's mind. I mean, one of the issues, again, if we're talking about folk myths. Never mind Surkov. I mean, in a way, Navalny has also become one, I mean, because we really don't know what he stands for. We know he's against Putin. We know he's against corruption. But what he's actually for is still, you know, really rather unclear. I think, and this is pure speculation, so treat it with inordinate amounts of caution. I would say, though, that he's neither sort of a patsy or stooge of the Kremlin, or a sort of cynical opportunist or whatever, but neither is he some ascetic. I think he realizes that in order to enact substantial change, he needs the support of the wealthy, he needs the support of elements within the elite, and therefore he is very happy to cultivate such figures. I mean, it was quite interesting. Recently, I was involved in a panel discussion at Chatham House in which Medvedev was involved. And one of the questions that he fielded was, would you support Navalny for president? And his answer was essentially positive, but slightly sort of cautious, saying, yes, he would, but he wants to see Navalny being involved in a multiple candidate sort of election. Navalny realizes that having the support of billionaires is a very, very handy tool. In some ways, I think I would slightly turn the question around. I would say it's not so much what's Navalny's game here. I mean, why not join the border? Right. And what political benefit would there have been to not doing so? It's more that it's quite interesting that precisely figures within the elite in whatever configuration are looking to build bridges with Navalny. Now, to me, that again, that says something about people wanting to hedge their bets for some Putin future.
So the political entrepreneurship is working both ways in this case, then?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, well, in a few minutes, we'll shift the focus from domestic affairs to foreign affairs and address a question on a lot of Russia watchers' minds. Is the reset between Moscow and Washington over? I'd like to remind you that you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. With me via Skype is special guest host Mark Galliotti, professor of global affairs at New York University and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows and the Moscow News column Siloviks and Scoundrels. Kirill Kobrin will be back in 2 weeks. I would also like to remind you, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org. You can also subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
We are very concerned about the situation. The decision made by the U.S. Foreign Relations Committee, in our view, goes against the overall positive spirit and letter of our relations with the United States that we have achieved over the past few years. There will be a response. It will be balanced. It will not cause any additional difficulties in our relations. But our response will be firm, and it will not have to be just symmetric.
That was Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister, Sergei Ryabkov, speaking on June 27th about the approval by the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee of a bill that would deny visas and freeze assets of Russian officials believed to be linked to the death of Sergei Magnitsky, an anti-corruption lawyer who died in pretrial detention in 2009. Magnitsky was arrested on what many believe to be trumped-up charges after exposing what he claimed was massive fraud by Russian officials. The bill still has to pass the full Senate and be signed into law by President Barack Obama. But the tension over Magnitsky and the ongoing disagreement between Washington and Moscow over what to do about the crisis in Syria has led some commentators and politicians to declare that President Obama's reset policy with Russia is dead in the water. Mark, what's your take? Is the reset over and a new period of conflict and confrontation on the horizon? Or is this just a bump in the road? What do you see going on here between the Russia and the United States?
Is the reset over? Well, I suppose really the question is, did it ever really begin? I don't want to be too cynical, but I've spent my time inside a foreign service apparatus, and I know both how political leaderships always like the idea of a big, flashy initiative, but also actually how little real impact they tend to have on the underlying realities. I would say, anyway, there are three core realities. One is that the Kremlin and the White House, I suppose I should say the US White House, do have very, very different understandings of the world, not necessarily competing, but with relatively little compatibility at times. The second reality, though, is actually that US and Russian global interests often don't really intersect. And we've seen that on a whole variety of issues, when there is common advantage, they're perfectly willing to cooperate, whether it's patrolling the seas off Somalia or resisting jihadism in Afghanistan. And the third point is that, again, I would say that the underlying processes have not been derailed. Put aside the rhetoric of the reset, Russia is experiencing increasing economic engagement with the rest of the world, and that includes the United States. We do have a rise of Russian civil society whose worldview is much closer to the West and so forth. And I think it's from these longer term processes that we're going to see a meaningful and lasting reset. So I'll offer that lengthy sort of discussion. I mean, to answer your actual question, I don't see some grand conflict as such on the horizon of anything else. Yeah. I think a continuing time of, you know, often spats, but it will be a two steps forward, one step back process of building a more practical, positive relationship between Russia and the United States.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, and I think we have to bear in mind what the reset, even by the rhetoric of the U.S. administration, was supposed to be and what it was not supposed to be. It wasn't supposed to be a love fest, right? It was basically, as you just said, cooperating where we have points of common interests. We've seen a lot of this, and to be honest, a lot of it's borne a lot of fruit. I mean, in terms of the transit of military hardware to Afghanistan, for example, that was a function of the reset. The greater pressure we're seeing on Iran over their nuclear alleged nuclear program, that is a function of the reset. These are the areas that the administration had hoped to focus on. What it seems to me that the Obama administration is doing now is what every U.S. president, regardless of what party they come from, must do with Russia. They must have this balancing act. On one hand, Russia's a great power. We have to have dealings with them because there's problems that we must cooperate on in the world. On the other hand, the United States can't ignore human rights issues, and Russia is a chronic violator of human rights. So there's going to be this tension and this balancing act, whether the president's name is Clinton, Bush, or Obama, or Reagan, for that matter. Mm-hmm. So I think what's going on right now, I think, has been over dramatized. It is, after all, an election year in the United States.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, there are some specific irritants, and we can come back to actually the sort of details of this whole Magnitsky Act and the pressure that is rising on some parts in the United States that saying, you know, America should actually be trying somehow to actively bring about some kind of change in Russia. But as regards the Russians themselves, yeah, of course, they'll talk tough. But one of the sort of the basic indicators is this. Are the Russians willing to sacrifice their own interests in the name of challenging the United States or sort of turning away engagement with the United States? And the answer always seems to be no. Mm-hmm. When it comes down to it, Russia will act in its best interests, and its best interests sometimes involve working with America, sometimes don't. But it certainly does not seem to be willing to divert economic or political capital into actively confronting the United States. So I think in that respect, precisely, we see that, shorn of all the sound and fury, the rhetoric, beyond that, yes, we do see a slow coming together of these two great powers.
Right. And even on the Magnitsky bill, there is some room for a kind of, at least within the United States political system, a kind of face-saving solution, as that is to pair it with the repeal of Jackson-Vanik, which is something Russia's long wanted and which would kind of give President Obama a way out of this impasse.
Yeah, though I have a feeling that's too little too late, because actually the way the Russians will see it is that it actually will turn it round. I mean, those who are more willing to be sceptical of the United States will see it as, they'll repeal Jackson-Vanik, but they'll just simply slap some new anti-Russian legislation in place. I mean, the thing about Magnitsky is that, on the one hand, it says absolutely nothing, in the sense that the United States always has the right to reject entry.
Exactly.
Whom they regard as not conducive to American interests. They always have the right, under executive orders, to go after or freeze the assets of those they feel involved in criminal acts. The problem was that very much this was a headlined, a specific bill that played into the hands of those nationalists within Moscow who felt, therefore, they were being treated in a particular sort of partial manner, which is actually true. And although the latest iteration of the act is much more generic, it's not just simply talking about Russia, that kind of nuance doesn't really play. So on one level, it was a pointless bit of political theatre. Why Magnitsky, who his case was tragic and horrific and definitely needs some kind of proper retribution, but why he was different from all those many other Russians who don't happen to be well-educated, working for a highly active Western businessman, why they don't get the same sort of preferential treatment when they die in some Russian prison, it is a separate issue. So I very much see Magnitsky as a slightly unfortunate political rather than substantive incident. But for all that happens, you know, whether it crosses, whether it's watered down, whether there's some kind of swap or whatever, it's not going to derail the fundamentals of the relationship.
Right. Now, something else I wanted to kind of address with you, Mark, and this is it's related to the reset. There's been a lot of assertions now, as Russian-American relations appear to be deteriorating, that the reset was a failure. This is something that's been we've been hearing coming out here and there. But couldn't you argue, and leaving aside the questions of the military transit to Afghanistan, the pressure on Iran, but strictly from the point of view of what's happening in Russian civil society right now, and don't get me wrong, this is all happening as a result of the actions of Russians, but don't you think the lessening of tensions that came about with the reset, pulling U.S.-Russian relations back from the low point that they were in before the reset took hold, didn't this kind of give a little bit of oxygen to the pro-Western part of society that is making up part of this protest movement? And in this sense, couldn't you say the reset was one of many independent variables that helped lead to where we are right now, domestically speaking, in Russia, I mean?
I wish I could give you a straightforward yes or no answer, but again, I'm going to fall back on that sort of classic academics on the one hand and on the fourth hand and so forth. Yes, it certainly created that kind of extra freedom of maneuver, shall we say, within the more liberal elements of civil society. But one has to balance that against the way that the frankly pretty vicious campaign against US Ambassador Mike McFaul carried with it, you know, has also allowed people to then characterize, not always particularly effectively, but nonetheless, attempt to characterize civil society as being tools of the US State Department, tools of foreign regime change. However, again, I mean, I think if we talk about underlying processes, I mean, here's one example. I mean, it's only about, I think, 4,000 or so Russian students who study in institutes of higher education in the United States, which is pitifully few, considering, you know, the number of students and, in fact, the intellectual capacity of those Russians. However, because Putin wants to see an advanced higher education sector, precisely because of its economic and technological impact on building a strong, powerful Russia, they're putting a lot of money into that, which will also mean a lot more Russian students are going to study abroad, including the United States, which means they're going to see what an American system looks like in all its glories and flaws, and then bring that knowledge back to Russia. So, I mean, I think, again, everything that helps this engagement process does actually help the process of change within Russia. So in that respect, yes, the reset probably did actually have a positive impact. In opening that window of opportunity just at the right moment, now it may well be in some ways be a problem for the political movements as they face this propaganda campaign. But the point is they're now much more deeply rooted than they were a year, 2 years, 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. So they're much, much better positioned to actually be able to weather that and indeed turn it back and use it as a way of ridiculing.
Well, I would push it a little bit farther, Mark. I would say that propaganda campaign, whether it be accusing the State Department of orchestrating everything or, you know, this vicious campaign against Ambassador McFaul, I would say that this campaign has been very ineffective in this atmosphere. I mean, soon after the Bolotna Ploshets demonstrations, when all of the, you know, the Gosdep, all the State Department propaganda, the propaganda against the State Department came out, there were people on at the next demonstration with signs saying, "Hillary Clinton, where's my money?" Right. And some of these were nationalists. Some of these were nationalists joking about, yeah, God, I'd love to be getting some money from Hillary Clinton. It's become a joke. I mean, remember Ksenia Sobchak's program called Gosdep was a parody of this propaganda campaign. So I think this is less effective than it once would have been. And part of that is the result of the reset, because how can you demonize this country you're supposedly having these good relations with, right?
I agree with you. I think that's spot on. Again, because I think the whole point is exactly that the protest movement is now strong enough and confident enough that it can handle that kind of propaganda attacks and, in fact, quite the opposite, use it as a tool for further ridiculing it. But let's just mention one other thing. I mean, there was a recent Nevada poll about the Magnitsky Act, which on all Russian television has been demonized as this extraordinarily evil, anti-Russian measure. Now, the largest proportion basically said that they didn't really have any opinion one way or the other. But more people, substantially more people, actually said that they were in favour of this act, this American act, which is essentially criminalising and excluding a whole swathe of members of the upper Russian elite, compared with those who thought it was a bad thing. So I think, again, it does speak to some deeper processes going on, where actually ordinary Russians have no problem with the Americans causing trouble for the corrupt kleptocratic elite.
Which they're getting tired of. So, yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah.
One last thing I wanted to discuss very briefly before we wrapped up, Mark, is the larger kind of question looming behind all of this, and that is, how much can the West or outside actors really affect internal Russian politics?
To be honest, not a lot. And in fact, I would say that their main option is to make things worse. Any attempt at overt manipulation of Russian domestic politics is going to be probably counterproductive. And more to the point, is almost impossible to predict the outcomes. Even if one looks at very different situations, of course, even if you look at the Arab Spring, one can see actually the distinct limitations of attempts just to shape political changes. But on the other hand, as I said, the West could certainly avoid making things worse. Last thing I would want to see is State Department or any other Western government actually trying to sort of actively promote one political movement over another. But what it can do precisely is it can create situations in which local Russians can actually bring about their own change. I mean, for example, encouraging travel, encouraging engagement, whether it's business or education or cultural, all these things that actually undermine the control of information and the sense of being a beleaguered state, which has always been such a great virtue for the deep state in Russia. Anything like that in the long term will help.
It seems to me these things are happening right now under the much beleaguered reset. Unfortunately, that is all we have time for today. As always, I could probably go on with you for hours, Mark, but I don't have hours. So I'd like to remind everybody that you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. With me from Vermont via Skype has been special guest host Mark Galliotti, professor of global affairs at New York University, author of the blog In Moscow Shadows and the Moscow News column Siloviks and Scoundrels. Thanks again for a great discussion, Mark.
My very great pleasure.
The Power Vertical podcast will have a brief hiatus next week when I take a much-needed break. Both Kirill and I will be back in the studio with another installment on July 13th. And just in case anybody didn't notice that, that's Friday the 13th, by the way. But I'm sure Tanya will be able to prevent any evil spirits or supernatural phenomena from invading our studio. Along those lines, a big thanks to our wizard of a producer, Tanya Koncheva, who makes the trains run on time in the studio and is a virtual musician in the editing booth. I'd also like to remind you that you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. See you again in 2 weeks, and as always, now I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.